This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my incredible and amazing and oh-so-inquisitive friends. You are looking fantastic. Hi, my name is Jed Lee, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, chemists, rocket scientists, and other experts as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, cooperation, creativity, and critical thinking. Right now, please welcome to the show my partner in exploration, the Admiral of Adventure, our Dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson.
Hello, Jet.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm wonderful, Jennifer. What's going on?
Well, we have a very tiny podcast today for everyone.
Tiny podcast? I have absolutely no idea what you could be referring to.
Well, why don't you spin the wheel and let's find out what I'm talking about.
Here we go.
What is nanotechnology anyway?
What is nanotechnology anyways? What's nano? Did he say nano or nana? I mean, nana, my nana, I know that, but I don't know nano thing. What's this stuff going on? What's going on here?
Oh, nanotechnology is amazing. It's all about things that are very, very, very small. That stuff that you like talking about that you can't see.
Uh-huh.
But we have an amazing guest today, Dr. Jane Frommer. She is a chemist and also started some of the very early work with nanotechnology, and she is going to explain all of this to us and to our listeners in a very fun and exciting way.
That's awesome. Hey, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Jane.
Thank you. It's so great to be here, and it's so great to be able to help explain this mystery of all things nano.
It is a really cool mystery. So tell us, what is nanotechnology?
So nanotechnology, let's look at the word. Let's start by looking at the word. Technology we all know because we're all techno nerds these days with all of the devices we have around with us. So why did they stick the nano part on the word technology? Where did they grab nano from? Well, they grabbed it from a ruler.
Oh, that's interesting. You don't even think about that.
Yeah, because we don't typically say, hey, would you measure my foot size with a nano, do they? And one of the reasons they don't is because we're talking about a teeny, teeny, tiny ruler in this case, of which your foot would be probably thousands, millions, maybe billions of nanos. We're talking about a ruler that we use in science to measure the distance between atoms and molecules. And that distance is called a nanometer. I kind of give you a sense of how small that is?
Yeah. I mean, wait, you said the distance between atoms and molecules, like atoms that you can't really even see. So we're talking, this is very, very, very small.
It's about as small as it gets. Although scientists keep getting better and better at looking within each of the things we think is finally the smallest building block, and they find there's more building blocks inside of that, like gluons. But that's another situation.
That's for the particle physics guys, yes.
Exactly. Exactly. So the way I like to explain or relate a nanometer to what you know in your life around you is to use our friend the ant. Now, an ant has something called a compound eye. And just look that up. You've probably seen a picture of an ant up close. They have a compound eye. It looks like the surface of a soccer ball or a bumpy ball. And growing out between some of those segments in the eye is a little fiber. It's a sensor. And they use that to sense things around them. And that sensor is about 1 micron across. Wow. So why am I mentioning a micron when we're talking nanometers today? Well, you take that micron, that little fiber that grows out of an ant's eye that you probably can't see with your own eye, but you could see it with an optical microscope. You take that fiber and you divide it into 1,000 parts. Bingo, that's a nanometer.
Wow.
All right. Dr. Jane, I'm sorry. I gotta ask, you know, are you just like kidding us? You just like, it's not really there, you know, cause I mean, how did we discover nanometer things so tiny? It's almost like somebody made it up and said, you know, this is here. Just believe me.
Well, in fact, we have known that the nanometer is a real scale for measuring the distances between atoms or molecules. In fact, by measuring signals that we get off of large chunks of material, large crystals of material, you can shoot energy at those and get back certain patterns which can be interpreted as the spacing between those atoms. And so we have had evidence of this nanometer ruler distance between atoms and molecules as long as we've had materials, large amounts of materials that we can measure. So if you're thinking that we've always known that nanometer scale's been there, so what's new about nanotechnology? Well, notice that I used the word large before. You needed relatively large amounts of material to get those signals off of when you make those measurements. Well, now what we're doing, which is really nano-fantastic, is being able to control the atoms and the molecules one by one on this scale that they're assembled on. And that's where nanotechnology arises from, the word control, being able to controllably see things one by one on that scale and to manipulate things one by one on that scale.
How do you do that? I mean, because you're saying you can't even see these unless you're using a microscope, correct? A special type of microscope to see them. So how do you move something that's that small? Do you have tools or?
Well, in fact, that was critical to having reliable control over materials, both to see them and to move them, was the evolution of instrumentation to become more and more reliable and more precise. Think, for example, of that telephone, which you might maybe saw in your grandmother's house.
That we all had, but sure.
It was big. It was clunky. We didn't think of it as big and clunky in the day. We thought it was just very functional. But it was rather big and clunky if you compare it to what we call a telephone today, that thing that you watch YouTubes on in your back pocket. Things kept getting more and more miniaturized. And how did that happen? Engineering evolved in such a way that we can control processes on a smaller and smaller scale.
Wow.
We got smarter and smarter about how do you harness energy and how do you focus it down and how do you make things at smaller and smaller sizes more and more reliably. Chips, semiconductor technology, these are maybe words you've heard before. That was the whole industry of harnessing energy and materials on a controllable scale and making things smaller and smaller so that you can wear a computer in your back pocket now, whereas in your parents' day, that would have been a, oh, you got to be kidding me kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first computer I got when I went to the Naval Academy, they issued us computers. It was the Zenith 248, and it was probably, oh gosh, the size of, it took up more than half of my desk, and now it's, that probably would be what the equivalent of not even a calculator technology wise these days.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how is it that that kind of evolution to make things tinier, how did that come about to our actually being able to observe atoms and molecules? Well, that reduction of scale, being able to see things more reliably, has allowed us to move a probe, move a measuring device around all that much more precisely. So we know if we're sitting on an atom or over an atom, we know with very high precision whether we are in the midst of a crystal lattice or whether we're sitting over, not literally sitting, but our instrument is sitting over a void. So it has precision to be able to move with very great certainty. And that motion might sound silly. You can move to your left or move to your right. What's the big deal about that? But when we're talking about moving the distances of molecules or atoms, you really got to know whether you moved 1 nanometer or whether you moved 1.1 nanometer. And that ability just wasn't as available in engineering. And I really do cite the engineers in large part for having refined such devices as piezoelectrics, for example. That's a wonderful word to do a science project on someday, to give us confidence that when we say we want to be moving by a nanometer, we are moving by a nanometer. Now, additionally, engineers have evolved detectors, which is to say the instrumentation that receives signals from materials that we're investigating. And so we're much more sensitive to being able to detect just a few molecules or atoms or signals from them, electrical signals or optical signals from them, than we previously were when we needed large amounts of material in order to get a signal that we could understand or identify the material by.
It still boggles my mind that people were able to think on that level to make those discoveries.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think that's amazing.
They were, and particularly engineers, as I've mentioned already, developing the instrumentation, but physicists were very interested in looking at crystal structures, the way that one atom of silicon sits next to another atom of silicon that sits next to another one, and ad infinitum until you have a silicon wafer, for example, or a silicon crystal that you build a silicon wafer from. And so they were ever intent on understanding how atoms pack together to make metals and semiconductors and insulators to give them the metallic or conducting properties or the insulating properties. And how does that structure and packing, in fact, determine whether it's an insulator or a conductor?
So what can you do with nanotechnology? Like, what have you done in your career with it? Because I know there's so many different areas you can go into.
Well, I'm so glad you asked. I'm not one of those physicists I've just been praising, and I'm also not one of those engineers that I so admire. I come from a very different discipline that Jed, in fact, mentioned earlier in this program, and I am a chemist. And what happened was I was fortunate to be in the midst of the development of instrumentation called scanning probes instrumentation. Sometimes scanning tunneling was an early name, or atomic force was an early name. The word microscope, by the way, is often put on this line of instrumentation, and I've avoided using that word up to now because it tends to make people think about peering through eyepieces and optically looking at something. And in fact, if you look at the word microscope, to scope something out on the micro scale, it doesn't have light in the name at all. It really means to magnify things or to look at things on the very small scale. Okay, I diverge a little bit here, but my point is that this new generation of instruments that could look at materials on the very small scale was evolving in several labs around the world, one of which was the IBM Research Laboratories in the 1980s. And I was very fortunate that I, being at the IBM Research Laboratory in the 1980s, also was working in a lab as a chemist right next to the lab that was also helping to invent and evolve these instruments. And I would sit with these folks at lunchtime, and they would talk about silicon atoms next to each other, and we saw what's called a 7x7 reconstructions of silicon atoms, and they were so excited, and I was sitting there thinking, this is great, but how many times can you keep looking at silicon atoms when there's so many other beautiful atoms and molecules out there in the world? And by the way, we chemists have been thinking on the nanometer scale forever when we think about building and designing new molecules. Yes. Our Lego kits in our minds really are on the nanometer scale. So how about we take your beautiful instruments and combine them with our beautiful molecules?
And did they go for that? I hope that, because it sounds like a great plan to me.
They sure did not.
Oh, they did sure not. Oh, okay.
You want to put what in our instruments? We have pristine, clean instruments here, and you want me to put what inside of it? So I'm specifically an organic molecule, and that was my interest. Organic molecules are assemblies of carbon atoms, and they often have oxygen and nitrogen in them. They're what your body's mostly made up of, are organic molecules. And sometimes physicists will kind of wryly call our organic beauties chicken fat.
Oh. Yeah. I'm assuming that's not a positive thing.
That sounds like molecule shaming to me.
It sounds like what, Jed?
Sounds like molecule shaming to me.
In today's lingo, it is. Yeah, they, in other words, they thought of organic molecules as those contaminants that they wanted to keep out of their instruments, not intentionally put into their instruments.
How did this get resolved?
Yeah. I kind of persisted in my belief that, guys, you're sitting on a gold mine here. We really have to apply it to some of the issues or scenarios of chemistry, because there's just too much goodness there not to. And I found in that collection of physicists an ally, someone who was willing to use his instrument to look at some of our molecules. Truth be told, and here's where you hear the stories that maybe don't go into publication, he was running his instrument and having some difficulties. He was running his instrument and he was getting images not of the silicon wafer that he put in there, but he was seeing other features on his sample that he couldn't explain. And what's more, they kind of moved around and they had odd shapes. Remember, we're talking on the nanometer scale here. And so in our conversation, lunchtime conversation, he said, what could these be? Silicon isn't this mobile. Silicon wouldn't move around in this manner. And so we agreed, you know what? You probably do have organic contamination in your instrument, but how do you prove it? And then in steps the chemist and says, well, you're looking at kind of amorphous blobs just moving around on that surface. What if we put an organic molecule there which has such an unusual shape that it couldn't be something which just came in arbitrarily? It has to have been that exact molecule. It has to be of a geometry, of a shape that you just can't deny that this isn't arbitrary. This was designed very intentionally. So they said, what kind of molecules would fit that bill? And again, bringing a few more chemists together, we decided that liquid crystals would be a good class of molecules that take on very known shapes, not only a single molecule, but when those molecules pack together, they take on very unusual and distinctive patterns.
So, go ahead, Jed.
No, I'm just in awe here. No,
well, I was going to say, okay, so all of this is amazing with nanotechnology. Let's bring it back to the kids a little bit. So what would they see around them that has nanotechnology in it? There's what, materials? But can you name some of these things that they would see?
Yeah, well, actually, let's continue in that vein we were just talking about with liquid crystals. So where would we get a sample of liquid crystals other than to go to a chemical supply house and buy them? Well, in fact, your watch, the digital watches, have liquid crystals in them. And so you could just kind of sacrifice, maybe take the one that's broken already and sacrifice it and take the liquid crystal out and put it in one of these microscopes. But still, to get to your question of, was that always nanotechnology in my watch even before we called it nanotechnology? Well, in fact, a liquid crystal, briefly, it works by having molecules line up, one right next to the other, and then by applying electricity to it, an electrical field, you can get those molecules to shift slightly their positions. And in shifting slightly, they let a different amount of light through. And so the idea here is that we knew about the position of those molecules all along in large amounts, but what we didn't know was how does that last layer of molecules that actually sits on that electrode surface, how does it differ from the way the molecules above it that are swimming around in a sea of molecules that aren't actually sitting on the electrode, how do they pack differently and how does that affect the way that light goes through? So what we were able to demonstrate with our instruments was how that last layer of molecules packed together in forming a ordered array that we could switch with electricity. So in some ways, your digital readouts have always been a form of nanotechnology.
Are glasses made with, you know, really fine type, the plastics that make the glasses now? Would they be made with nanotechnology?
Well, probably, but my mantra there is, frankly, nature has always worked on the nano scale because it's always worked with molecules. It's always assembled things out of molecules. So, in fact, nature has been the greatest nanotechnologist of all coming along. We're playing catch-up. As human beings, we're playing catch-up. So whereas, and we're doing it slowly, but they've been putting coatings on glasses for a while now so that they don't fog or so they don't glare. And they've been pretty thick layers that we've been putting on. What we are evolving to is the ability to put much thinner layers on. And in putting thinner layers on, we can even get down to a monolayer. A monolayer means one layer of molecules. And what would the ruler say about one layer of molecules? That's just a nanometer, a few nanometers thick. So in fact, as we get better and better at making things out of very small components or on very small dimensions, we are moving into nanotechnology, knowing, calling it that or not. You know, one area where you probably hear the word nano a lot is nanoparticles. A lot of products now will say they have nanoparticles in them. Your washing machine has silver nanoparticles in it, I see advertised. I don't know quite why they're advertising that. I don't think I'd want to know that, but I want to have silver nanoparticles in my life. But nonetheless, the idea is that they are now making materials on a scale which greatly enhances the property of materials from when we had them in what we call bulk or large materials down to small dimensions. And there's two properties in particular which you gain an advantage by working with small dimensions or nanoparticles. One is you can get those objects into places that you couldn't necessarily get things into before. Excuse me. And where many of those examples come from are biological, using them as therapeutics. When you have very small objects that they can get into places that large objects can't. They can go through membranes where large objects can't. They can pack differently. So, for example, if you want to deliver a therapeutic across the blood-brain barrier, you have to be very careful about designing the particle in such a way that it both is of a size that can pass through that barrier and it's of a chemical composition that the brain doesn't recognize as foreign and then reject it. So control over size is one important thing so that you can get it in places very specifically. Another thing is the very small particle will have a much larger surface area to volume ratio than a large item. I don't know if this is obvious to young people, but in fact, when you have so much of the material in your object, in your particle, exposed to the surface and available to the environment around it, it can make it much more powerful, a delivery agent, than if you've locked up a lot of that material in the core or the interior of that particle.
Right. It's almost like a surface area for them would be like taking like a ball and maybe opening it up and spreading it. It's just a visual image that they could see that you can think about so that the surface area has more to make more contact and can be more reactive and have all these extra things. Yeah.
Exactly. More reactive, more available to its surroundings. And so that's another advantage that it brings, that a nanoparticle brings to using materials in larger quantities, is that their cargo is more available.
Wow. Dr. Jane, I think I could talk to you for about 5 years and still not even scratch the surface of everything that you're doing. It is fascinating. One thing I learned today is that I'm going to start measuring how fast I run in nanometers because that makes me sound like
how far you run. That means it means a lot farther. There you go.
But I was wondering, we like to make our show totally interactive. We love to challenge our audiences to explore our subjects a little bit deeper. Do you have a challenge that we can give to the kids today?
Well, along these lines, Jennifer, and what you and I were talking about before of how do individuals behave differently alone versus in a group. And so the example we had of the molecules was how do molecules behave differently if you have just one or two or if you have a whole glass full of them, as in water. Well, the same thing with people. How would you do something differently if you were alone versus if you were with a group of people, a small group of people or a large group of people? How would you lift a heavy object differently if you were alone, maybe in small steps, than if you had a lot of people, each of which could reach in and lift the article? I know this isn't as succinct, Jed, perhaps, but
no, this
was perfect, I thought. I thought that was perfect because – you just gave them a way to use themselves, imagine themselves as a nanoparticle.
Yeah.
Versus a nanomaterial, like, you know, a bigger group. That was great. I love that.
Yeah. So Dr. Frommer, you want kids to start to observe how they might act differently when they're in a group as opposed to the way they'd act when they're by themselves.
That's right. That's right. Or if they're in a small group, if there's just two of you and you're having a conversation, you'll probably come to agreement on things pretty easily. You'll see things through the same way. But if there's a third person there who comes in with a third opinion, well, that might kind of shift the way the two of you were thinking about it, or you have a two versus one dynamic going on there. That can be good, and that could give more weight to an idea, or it could kind of fracture it and have more opinions that don't agree with each other. Then bring in another person or two, and you can have so many more behaviors. Each person doesn't bring in one more behavior. Each person brings in the opportunity to create multiple new behaviors, because that one person who comes in interacts with all the others that were in the group before then. And so the amount of behaviors that can come out as you bring in each new person really begins to explode. And compare that to just you walking down the street measuring your nanometers with one line of thought and one behavior. The analogy being here that groups interacting with each other bring out properties that can be so different from either a single person or a single atom, or thousands and thousands when you do start to get collective behavior in very large groups. That's just a function of statistics or how you deal with many, many numbers, larger numbers.
Wow. Yeah, I think that's amazing. So you take this same analogy, and this is how it works on the nano level. You have one nanoparticle versus thousands, and thousands might interact differently than just that single one. Fabulous. That was it. Okay, so kids, this is what you need to do. You need to take up Dr. James' challenge and maybe write a little something or draw a picture of the different types of interactions, and then ask your teacher, your parents' permission, and tag us on our website, or tag us on our Twitter, which is at KidsSolve, or you could go to our website and email us, because we would love to see and what you've learned from these interactions that Dr. Jane has given you the challenge for. So this has been great. Thanks for being on the show, Dr. Jane.
You're welcome. And I didn't use any of my notes about polymers or about bubbles or about oil droplets, so we'll just have to save that to another time.
Wow, Jennifer, that was like a mind-boggling episode of the show. Who knew there's so much to learn about stuff that's so small?
Right, and it has such a huge effect. Did you like the challenge about taking a look at how you interact by yourself versus a group? I thought that was so cool.
It really is. And at first, I didn't quite understand what she was talking about. But yeah, we do act differently when we're alone and then when we're in a group. And so it makes sense that like other stuff does the same thing.
Yeah, and nanoparticles do that too. So if you want to see some of these things that we've been talking about, make sure you go to our website, solveitforkids.com. Click on this episode with Dr. Jane, and you can see what nanotechnology looks like on the very, very microscopic level, and do the challenge. If you do the challenge, you could win a copy of my book, Super Gear, Nanotechnology and Sports Team Up.
Ah, wow, what a great prize. That is a fantastic book. Well, I can't wait to see everybody next week for another episode of
Solve It for Kids.